You're listening to The Briefing, first broadcast on the 10th of March 2024 on Monocle Radio. Hello and welcome to The Briefing, coming to you live from Studio One here at Midori House in London. I'm Vincent McAvinney. Coming up on today's programme...
The name of operation is Maidan 3. It means to change the president. They will use any instruments they have.
Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky replaces the head of his personal protection unit after Russian infiltration. Iran-backed Houthi rebels vow to broaden their attacks in the Red Sea. How much longer can companies afford alternative routes? Plus the latest from Trump's hush money trial, and could Britain be about to get a new political party? All that right here on The Briefing with me, Vincent McAvinney. To Ukraine first, where President Zelensky has fired the head of his personal protection unit after two of its top officials were detained over an alleged Russian-backed assassination plot. Serhiy Rud had led the president's security detail since 2019. For more on this, I'm joined now by Olga Tokariuk, a Ukrainian journalist based in London. Olga, thank you for joining us. Firstly, can you explain for those who don't know what happened this week with those two colonels in the State Guard?
Hello, Vincent. Well, you know, as always with this almost spy-like situations, the things are very murky. Everything we know is that on May 7th, the Ukrainian security services, the SBU, announced that they stopped an attempt to kill President Zelensky, that they detained two colonels of his personal bodyguard service, who allegedly were acting on Russian orders and were tasked with killing the president. The details that emerged, add another like layer of mystery to all this issue, because it is reported that they were actually they smuggled some weapons into Kyiv from the occupied territory of Ukraine. And then they were also about to give Russians the coordinates of Zelensky's whereabouts. And then Russians would target him with missiles and then with drones to present it as if it's, you know, just like an attack, not necessarily on the president. So, as I said, like the details are very spotty. We don't really know what happened and, you know, what was the plan. But it's worth saying that it's not the first attempt to... Zelensky, there were more than 10 in the past. What is significant this time is that the people who planned it were very close to him. They were part of his bodyguard service, and therefore the sacking of the head of the service was not surprising, because these two colonels were his direct subordinates.
There was some reporting, though, that this had in some ways been a success for Ukrainian intelligence, because they had clocked this plot and were monitoring these two individuals before they then moved on them. Why do you think, though, that President Zelensky has decided to get rid of Serhiy Rud, who leads his protection?
Well, it is certainly a success of the SBU, the secret services, that foiled this assassination attempt. Why Zelensky sacked the head of the bodyguard service? Well, obviously, because he cannot trust him anymore. If the head of that service did not notice two Russian spies operating under his, you know, leadership, that obviously is a signal that he is not very competent. So, President cannot trust him anymore, and therefore he sacked this person, and we don't yet know who will replace him. But, you know, I must also say that there have been some other scandals related to this institution. So recently, a man who is working also in this president's bodyguard service attacked with a knife a teenager in Kyiv. There was some argument on one of the funicular stations, and that boy was fatally wounded, and now the man is in custody. So it's not not the first scandal with, you know, people who represent that institution. I think there is a crisis in general of trust in it. And potentially, that's also Zelensky's an attempt to restore that trust with bringing new blood into this body.
President Zelensky has spoken of several plots over recent years to kill him. Have we somewhat taken his safety through all of this for granted because he has been just so visible? Is there a massive operation still behind the scenes to keep him continuously safe and moving?
Absolutely, you know, and even just what we get from the news is not much, but even in the recent months, this is at least the third attempt to harm or kill President Zelensky. This one in May, a few weeks ago, there was a Polish national detained by Polish police in cooperation with the Ukrainian police, who again was accused of attempting and planning to murder President Zelensky on Russian orders. Then in March, there was an attack, a Russian missile attack in Odessa, with a missile landing 500 meters from the spot where President Zelensky was meeting with his Greek counterpart. So Russians are not renouncing, are not stopping their attempts to remove the Ukrainian president, because in their view, Zelensky is a very, you know, important figure unifying Ukraine. Russians see him a little bit as they see Putin. So they think, well, probably if Zelensky is not there, the Ukrainian resistance, Ukrainian state will just collapse. And with this, I think they completely fail to understand that Ukrainians are not fighting, you know, for Zelensky or for their president. They are fighting for their country. And therefore, of course, if successful and, you know, a murder of Zelensky would have devastating psychological consequences, but still it is unrealistic to expect that somehow Ukrainian resistance and resilience will be undermined or Ukrainian state will collapse.
There's been another staffing shakeup this week with President Zelensky replacing the special operations chief. This is the second time in 6 months. What should we read into that?
Yeah, well, you know, I've been trying to read some Ukrainian media and understand what's behind it. And I would say that there is even less information about this. What we know is that the previous chief of special operations was only appointed in November 2023. So it's less than 6 months in job, and now he's been sacked. A new head, whose name is Oleksandr Trepak, is actually a deputy chief of special operations, and he's been in this position for a while. People who are familiar with, you know, Special Operations Service and with him describe him as a very competent person who has been fighting and participating in Ukrainian special operations against Russian proxies since 2014. He was one of the defenders of Donetsk Airport, one of the most important battles in that first stage of Russia's war on Ukraine. He's very highly trusted by people inside the system, and they are mostly welcoming this move. And also another comment that I've seen from Ukrainian experts on this, they are saying that this is also an attempt somehow to diversify Ukrainian intelligence operations, because now basically they are monopolized by GUR, Ukrainian military intelligence, led by General Kirill Budanov. And now with this appointment of a, you know, more high profile, very highly reputable, trusted chief of forces of special operation forces, Zelensky is trying kind of to diversify these intelligence operations to boost them and also to avoid this monopolization in the hands of GUR.
And just finally, Olga, what's the morale been like in Ukraine after the US finally approved that $70 billion aid package? Has it given them a bit of a boost?
Yeah, well, we are exaggerating here. It was $61 billion, fortunately, not 70, but still, of course, very well, well, you know, received and very much welcome. We don't know, you know, how much of that aid package has already reached Ukrainian front lines. I suspect not that much. And actually, there have been some worrying news today in the morning that Russians were trying to undertake a major assault in Kharkiv region, which first were You know, the Ukrainian officials' reaction was like not to take it really seriously. Russians are trying to launch psychological operations and expect a lot of Russian disinformation regarding Kharkiv. But just before, you know, we spoke, the news came out. There was a confirmation from the Ukrainian government that indeed there was around 5 a.m. in the morning a major Russian assault trying to, break through Ukrainian defense lines in Kharkiv region. So that American aid package, I think, is very much looked forward to. Like, we hope it will be there as soon as possible. But of course, Russians will try to capture as much Ukrainian territory as they can until it's still not there.
Olga Tokariuk, thank you very much. Now here's Mariella Bevan with the day's other news headlines.
Thanks, Vincent. The United Nations General Assembly is set to back a Palestinian bid to become a full UN member today, recognising it as qualified to join and sending the application back to the UN Security Council to reconsider the matter favourably. This comes after the United States vetoed the move in a 15-member Security Council last month. The death toll from severe flooding in southern Brazil has risen to 107 as rescue operations continue and authorities begin to see the cost of recovering from the devastation in the state of Rio Grande do Sul. More rains are forecast in the coming days, raising fears that water levels will rise further in the inundated state capital of Porto Alegre and nearby towns where streets have turned into rivers. An Israeli singer, Eden Golan, qualified for the final of the Eurovision Song Contest despite protests. Her victory came hours after thousands of pro-Palestinian protesters gathered in the streets of Malmö, Sweden, where the contest is being held to show their support for Gaza. Those are the day's headlines. Back to you, Vincent.
Thanks, Mariella. To the Red Sea now, where an international task force continues its naval patrols to protect global shipping from Iran-backed Houthi rebels. Yesterday, the leader of the Houthis, Abdul Malik al-Houthi, said they would broaden their attacks to target the ships of any company related to supplying and transporting goods to Israel, regardless of their destination. Joining us now to discuss this is Iona Craig, a journalist who specialises in Yemen and the Arabian Peninsula. Iona, thank you for coming on the show. Firstly, many around the world are still feeling the cost of the Houthis' campaign at the till, but it feels like we haven't heard about successful strikes for a while now. What's been going on in the region?
Yeah, good afternoon, Vincent. Well, actually, we had a relatively quiet period in the middle of April last month. There was a lull of about 10 days when there weren't any Houthi attacks. And in response to that, there were therefore very few US-led strikes, which the UK has also been participating in inside Yemen against the Houthis. That ended towards the end of April. On the 24th, 25th of April, the Houthis sort of re-escalated, really, their attacks in the Red Sea. And we've now seen over the last sort of 2 weeks that re-escalation hitting the sort of heights of February, March in terms of attacks that they've been carrying out. And in addition to that threat that was made by Abdul Malik yesterday about expanding their attacks, they also previously, which is why we should take this threat now seriously, they previously threatened to expand attacks into the Indian Ocean. And we saw that materialize on the 25th, 26th of April, when an MSC vessel was targeted way out in the Indian Ocean, sort of 300 to 400 nautical miles from the Horn of Africa. So that has an even greater impact now on shipping that had already been diverting from the Red Sea, but it's going to mean an even further diversion from vessels that were trying to avoid being targeted by the Houthis and now going to have to go even further afield to keep out of range of the Houthis. Now they have decided to expand their attacks into the Indian Ocean.
Mm. And I mean, as it stands at the moment, what percentage of shipping is being diverted around that sort of long route going around the continent of Africa?
Well, Egypt have said now that they have confirmed that they have a reduction of 50% reduction in tax revenue from vessels going through the Suez Canal. So, yes, you've got a significant proportion now of vessels having to take the route round the South Africa and the long way around. So particularly that's harmful for traffic going into the Eastern Mediterranean because that's the longest way around they're going to have to take. But it also impacts vessels going to all parts of Europe and even to America, because a lot of those shipping vessels that are going into Europe and then heading on to the US afterwards. But yes, so you're looking at Egypt taking a sort of 50% hit as far as tax revenue is concerned. But and now with this kind of movement into strikes in the Indian Ocean in the last couple of weeks, you've had companies like Maersk and Hapag-Lloyd a warning of disruption going up by more than, you know, up to 20% in the second quarter of 2024 if they're having to avoid even further the shores of Yemen and the Houthi attacks.
And in terms of the costs for the companies that are doing the shipping, for manufacturers, for consumers, I mean, how sustainable is it for so much traffic to be diverted this way? And also the huge environmental cost, because it's more fuel, more emissions as well.
Yeah, and actually the latter point is probably, you know, the greatest one in many respects, because there's tax issues related to that from the EU as well, that the more fuel that is spent in shipping, then the more tax that has to be paid for environmental reasons. But yeah, I think the industry now has almost settled into this period of having to avoid the Red Sea and made these changes, you know, at the end of last year and early parts of this year. That they have been able to cope with, you know, the greater demand on shipping companies, that the supply chain and actual cargo vessels and shipping containers and all required to do that longer route with more time at sea has been coped with quite well by the industry. But yes, of course, the increased costs of all of that will continue as long as this does. And if the Houthis are, you know, threatening to not just extend their attacks on what vessels they're attacking, there's also been talk from the Houthis authorities about extending attacks into the Mediterranean, into the Eastern Mediterranean, because they've been very clear that their level of attacks on vessels, on commercial shipping, will relate directly to the level of violence in Gaza, and particularly if there is, you know, increased effort or attack on southern Gaza and on Rafah. And they've been very clear that if and when this attack on Rafah escalates, they will also escalate their attacks on international shipping. So I think we should take that threat seriously of a possibly reaching vessels in the Eastern Mediterranean, because, as I say, they previously threatened vessels in the Indian Ocean and, you know, sort of 6 weeks later started carrying out attacks on vessels in the Indian Ocean. So I don't think it's outside the realm of possibilities that this issue could spread not just from the Red Sea, the Gulf of Aden, and the Indian Ocean, but also to the Mediterranean.
And just finally, obviously, these weapons and these drones are being supplied by Iran. Has there been much success on the part of the action taken by the US and others in disrupting the supply routes from Iran to Yemen? And alternatively as well, I mean, this is costing Chinese companies. China has a lot of leverage over Iran. Have they been putting any more pressure on Iran to stop this disruption?
No, I think it's been quite clear, even when the US has approached Iran directly about this, Iran has turned around to US interlocutors and said, go and speak to the Houthis directly. So I think there's a real reluctance on the part of whether it be China or Iran to get involved in trying to prevent the Houthis doing what they're doing. But yeah, I think there is obviously a huge effort by the US and other allies to intercept these kind of munitions being brought into Yemen. But the biggest trouble is, particularly with drones, of course, is they don't have to be particularly large. They can be brought in components. The Houthis have now been trained by the Iranians to rebuild those drones once they arrive into the country in small parts. Yes, there have been some vessels that have been picked up at sea with components in them. But, you know, on the scale of it, the ability of the Houthis to still be able to bring elements in, and that a lot of those parts do come all the way from China, to then be able to build those drones once the parts are in Yemen, is still there. And it's quite clear with the level of strikes that we've seen over the last 10 days that they haven't really lost much, if any, capability to carry out attacks against commercial ships in the Red Sea and in the Indian Ocean.
Iona Craig, thank you. You're listening to The Briefing on Monocle Radio. You're back with The Briefing on Monocle Radio. I'm Vincent McAvinney. Donald Trump has spent another week in a New York City courtroom, coming face to face with the porn star Stormy Daniels for the first time in 18 years, as she testified against the former president over their affair and alleged hush money payment. Trump was also given a final warning about his social media posts attacking the trial and court staff, with the serious threat of jail time prompting the Secret Service to release a statement that they would indeed be able to facilitate this for him. For more, I'm joined by Jamie Floyd, New York-based attorney and author. Jamie, thank you for coming on the show. Firstly, what exactly has the court been hearing from Stormy Daniels this week?
Well, it's been quite an extraordinary week. She has been a surprisingly strong witness. She ended with a stronger day under cross-examination, I would say, from what I've heard, than she started under direct examination by the lawyers who put her there, the prosecutors, which is rather unusual. Generally, the cross-examination is withering, and that's where the witness falters, but she really rose to the occasion. And what she told was the story that I think now many Americans, at least, and I would say many people in the world have heard of this, these encounters that she had with Donald Trump, starting with the one that began in a hotel room. And she then wanted to be compensated for what she said was a degree of pain and suffering, because she had never really wanted, she said, to have any encounter with a man she said was much more powerful, but had promised her entree to television, especially The Apprentice. And we all associate Donald Trump, of course, with Celebrity Apprentice. And what she really, Vinny, served to do for the prosecution was not only present that bombshell witness, both literally and figuratively, but she tied up the fundamentals of the case. She's the linchpin. It is a case that's about documents and money payments, but what were the money payments for? Well, they were hush money payments, and what he was trying to hush up were these encounters with women, most significantly Stormy Daniels, or Stephanie Clifford, as she was named at birth.
And how has Donald Trump and the jury indeed reacted?
Well, it's very interesting. Most witnesses that come into that courtroom, indeed every witness, it seems, gives a glance at Donald Trump. One or two, like his former COO Weisselberger, even give him a little smile as if this is, you know, a social encounter. But there have been two women who have refused to look at Donald Trump, and that is Hope Hicks, who is his former communications director and a very close member of his inner circle. She was a couple of witnesses before Stormy Daniels, and then Miss Daniels herself. And Stormy Daniels refers to Trump as Mr. Trump. She has the protocols of the court and the decorum of the court down solid. She's dressed apparently in a very demure way yesterday in a buttoned up green dress. Apparently the jury's responding well to her testimony, but Susan Nicholas, Donald Trump's attorney, did very effectively cross-examine her, trying to demonstrate both a desire for financial compensation. In other words, you were all in this for the money, and also you just hate Donald Trump, don't you? Pulling up text messages and tweets that demonstrate that Ms. Daniels, of course, has no affection for Donald Trump and really would like to see him go to jail, is basically what the defense is trying to demonstrate. And Vinny, they were very smart to have a woman cross-examine this woman so that a man was not beating up on Stormy Daniels in front of the jury.
And what are we in for next week? And how serious is this threat of jail time should Donald Trump continue to post on social media about the trial?
Well, let's take each thing at one at a time. The witness who's currently on the stand and will return to the stand is a woman named Madeline Westerhout. She is the woman who sat right in front of the Oval Office. These women often, and they're almost always women, I can't think of a man, become very significant when scandal breaks. Rosemary Woods was the famous woman in the Nixon White House who was questioned vigorously about erasing 17 minutes of White House tape that became critical during the Watergate scandal. So this woman comes back to the stand, and she is testified about the checks that would come back and forth through the Oval Office, which would tie Donald Trump, who says he knew nothing about Stormy Daniels, back to the hush money scheme. And she was very weepy on the witness stand yesterday, and she will come back to the witness stand today. And the issue you asked about with the contempt problem, I think the judge is quite serious, Vinny, about putting Donald Trump in jail if he has to. He's made it very clear that he does not want to do this, but in every single case that Donald Trump has been a part of, and now there have been many, he has not been able to control himself. And some judges have actually used that language, Mr. Trump, you cannot control yourself. And Rashawn has now fined him thousands of dollars. And there are legal limits, Vinny, in our system as to how much money the judge can impose in fines. So he really may have no alternative but to show Donald Trump that he's serious by putting him in a holding cell for a few hours or maybe even a couple of days to try and, well, shut him up.
And fascinating that both, you know, the mayor of New York City, Eric Adams, and the Secret Service themselves have come out and said there are no practical issues to doing this. We can do it if the judge decides it. It would be quite remarkable. Well, Jamie Floyd, thank you very much. I'm sure we'll be speaking to you again about this trial. You are listening to The Briefing on Monocle Radio.
How long do you think it would take you to travel the world to hear from the most perceptive and relevant speakers on the global news agenda? To mix that up with a trip to visit the business people benchmarking best practice in media, retail and hospitality. And to make time, too, to delve into a rich mix of great design stories and rich cultural discoveries. Well, you can do all of this in just 60 minutes each week by tuning in to The Curator, a whistle-stop tour of the best of the last 7 days on Monocle Radio. Subscribe and download the show now or listen every weekend on Monocle Radio.
Now, Dominic Cummings is a name that you might remember from both Brexit and the Boris Johnson government. A self-styled disruptor with grand plans to reform the British state, he crashed and burned out of Downing Street after breaking the very COVID lockdown rules he designed and implemented. But now he's back, having fired salvos of criticism at his former party, the Conservatives, in the years since. He reportedly wants to set up a new political party. Joining me for more in the studio is Monocle Radio regular and associate fellow at Chatham House, Quentin Peel. Quentin, good to have you back in the studio. What do we know about Dominic Cummings' plans?
Well, he's been going on about this for a little while. I think he first mentioned it last year in an online column because essentially he says the Conservative Party is going to implode. He's right about that. The Conservative Party is going to just crash at the next election, and then I think there will be a battle royal for the spoils, and that's where he wants to get involved. He says he's got something called the Startup Party that will take over from the Conservative Party. It's not going to have Nigel Farage as a member, it's not going to be the Brexit Party, but it will be an anti-establishment party. So he's right about the Conservative Party, and I think he's wrong about his own party, because he's just too crazy, too poisonous for anybody to want to follow him.
Well, let's break some of that down. I mean, it's one thing to have ideas and a policy platform, but ultimately you have to have people to put up to be elected, and Britain's system is first past the post. It's incredibly hard to hack into. We have two very dominant main parties. I mean, what are the chances of him recruiting? Who might he get on board, and how likely could they actually make any ground? Because it's all, at the end of the day, about having these huge networks of volunteers and local parties in constituencies around the country.
Yeah, I mean, I just can't see him. He's not a popular figure. In fact, he's a profoundly unpopular figure. He's brilliant. There's no question about it. And he's a brilliant tactician. So if he could attach himself to a popular figure, indeed somebody like Nigel Farage, then it might work. Breaking into the first-past-the-post system is always going to be really difficult, and we've seen it with the Greens, the Lib Dems, and indeed the Brexit Party. You know, they never quite get what their vote says. So it's very difficult, but the Conservative Party, I mean, just imagine the situation. Say the Conservative Party has total meltdown, ends up with, you know, just number of MPs in two figures, 30, 40, something like that, then I think there would be a lot to play for. And the other thing that is breaking up, if you like, the first-past-the-post system is the rise of national parties like the Scottish National Party and the Welsh Party and so on. So you've got a fragmentation of politics happening, and therefore there might be a possibility. But as I say, it ain't going to be Dominic Cummings.
Well, yeah, I mean, Dominic Cummings is one of the person who is, it's always you, not me. He seems to have fallen out at various points with everyone involved with him. But I'm really curious about the platform that he's going after, because he says he's been conducting poll groups and he's come up with some ideas like closing sort of, he says, you know, the tax benefits for the 1% and having a stronger policy on immigration. Do you think he's tapping into something here, that he's getting something that just the mainstream parties aren't getting about the frustrations of the majority of British people?
Well, I think there are people trying to get at exactly those issues. So, anti-immigration, clearly that's part of the Reform Party's agenda. It's also part of the right wing of the Tory Party agenda. And yes, he wants to, he basically wants to completely overhaul and indeed smash the civil service. That's a different issue. And I think that's an issue where he'd be hard put to make much headway. So he will appeal perhaps to the Brexit voting working classes, that's a, you know, the Red Wall constituents. But he won't appeal to people who always voted Conservative precisely because it was the establishment party. I mean, he's part of that establishment. You know, his uncle was a Lord Chief Justice, but a senior judge.
Boarding school educated, and he went to
privately
Oxbridge,
educated.
Was a spaz.
Absolutely, yeah. So, he's got one slightly strange thing in his background, which he spent 3 years working in Russia, apparently, to set up an airline which never got off the ground. Nobody knows quite what he was doing there.
Not suspicious at all. And just finally, we've had Sir Keir Starmer, the Labour leader, down today talking about the small boats situation and scrapping the Rwanda policy that the Conservatives have so far failed to get working, putting the money towards cracking gangs in Europe. I mean, for those outside the UK, the way our system works is it's in the Prime Minister's discretion when to call an election. We all think it will probably be in October, November time. As it stands, I mean, the Conservatives, is there anything now that they could do in the next few months that might save them from what sounds like a really crushing defeat, which could be existential in some ways, particularly if afterwards they tack and perhaps have their own Corbyn moment where they go to the extreme of the party and have someone like Suella Braverman as their next leader?
Yeah, I mean, I think that is something that's going to be very difficult for them to avoid, because I think fundamentally what's wrong with the Conservative Party is not policy, it's incompetence. That really undermined what they'd always been elected for, that they were the people who got on with government and kept the show on the road. Actually, the combination of just a series of failed prime ministers, Theresa May, Boris Johnson, Liz Truss, and Rishi Sunak, well, he's quite sensible, actually just doesn't seem to be able to make a breakthrough. Mm. So I think that actually there's very little they can do about it, which is precisely why we're seeing all these members of parliament leaving the party, rats deserting a sinking ship.
Well, Quentin Peel, thank you very much. I'm sure we'll be speaking to you more over the next couple of months. That is all for this edition of The Briefing. It was produced by Paige Reynolds. Our researcher was George Ruskin, and our studio manager was Steph Chungu. The Briefing is back on Monday at the same time. You can find past episodes of this show and all of Monocle's programming at monocle.com. And do drop me an email about anything you've heard today, vm@monocle.com. I'm Vincent McAvinney. Goodbye, have a great weekend, and thank you for listening.